From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, cooking for people with AIDS, we talk with Robert Lehman, who is the executive chef at an organization that prepares and delivers meals for people with AIDS who are housebound. In his new book, Cooking for Life, he offers advice on reversing diarrhea, nausea, and low body weight, and how to prevent food contamination. Also, filmmaker Ken Burns, of the Civil War and baseball fame, tells us about his new PBS film on Thomas Jefferson. And Gerald Early continues his reflections on life at an African-American university. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Federal Aviation Administration is announcing plans to make it easier for travelers to know the safety records of major airlines. But the agency will not go as far as some of its critics want it, NPR Steve Inskeep reports.
An FAA official confirms reports that the agency will use the Internet to distribute safety figures to the public. If you want to know more about the airline you fly, you'll be able to quickly learn how often the airline has an accident. You can also learn how often it reports an incident, which is the industry term for an accident that almost happened, like two planes flying too close together. And the FAA will report how often it punishes an airline for violating safety rules. But the agency will not combine that information into an overall ranking showing which airline is safest. Airlines have resisted such a step for years. They argue that airline accidents are so rare that a single mishap can distort statistics, and they predict that too much public attention to safety figures will cause airlines to cover up safety problems instead of reporting and fixing them. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington.
The Israeli ambassador to the United States accuses Syria of spreading false reports that Israel has agreed to withdraw to its 1967 borders to secure peace with Syria. Ambassador Eliyahu Ben Elassar says there is no agreement, but he said Israel is ready to reopen peace talks with Syria immediately, anywhere, including in Damascus or Jerusalem. The denial conflicts with a report by Syria's chief negotiator, Walid Mualem. Mualem told the Journal of Palestinian Studies that Israel agreed to withdraw to the border that existed before Israel captured the Golan Heights in the Six-Day War of 1967. The Pakistani Supreme Court today upheld the dismissal of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, and it has ordered new elections. The decision ends Bhutto's battle to return to power without another vote. Pakistani President Farooq Lagari dismissed Bhutto last November. Phil Goodwin reports for the BBC from Islamabad.
After a short deliberation, the seven-member bench of the Supreme Court decided by a 6-1 majority that Farooq Lagari was right to sack Benazir Bhutto's government on all counts. It said there was evidence of corruption, nepotism, misrule, that the administration was responsible for the extrajudicial killings of hundreds of activists from an opposition party, the MQM, in Karachi, and had illegally tapped the phones of senior judges and politicians. It's a complete endorsement of the president. He had staked his reputation and career on the case. Benazir Bhutto's first reaction was to consult her lawyers, but an appeal is unlikely. When the decision was announced, her supporters staged angry protests outside the court. Police beat them back with batons.
Bill Goodwin reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 41.5 points at 6,697. Trading is active. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, Ford Motor Company says profits in the fourth quarter tripled on strong results at its U.S. automobile operations. Still, analysts believe the trouble spot for Ford continues to be in the global marketplace. Bloomberg's Paul Lynn reports.
Ford had profit from operations of $1.10 a share, easily beating Wall Street estimates. But while the company saw strong sales of trucks and a new sport utility vehicle in North America, analysts say Ford continues to see weakness in Europe and Latin America.
This was something that management had been indicating would be a continuing problem for them. In the press release accompanying the fourth quarter results, they continued to view Europe as a difficult market with highly competitive conditions. And, of course, in Latin America, the problem is primarily Brazil, where they are, in effect, rebuilding a company after a rather difficult joint venture with Volkswagen broke apart a year ago.
That's Marianne Keller at Furman Sales. Ford is the last of Detroit's big three automakers to report fourth quarter results. General Motors on Tuesday was the only one to report a drop in profit for the quarter. This is Paul Lynn.
The government says orders to factories for expensive durable goods fell unexpectedly in December by 1.7%. Durable goods are expensive products like cars and computers that are expected to last for at least 3 years. Falling orders can lead to slower production and fewer jobs. The FBI is looking for software pirates, but it hasn't arrested anyone yet. The FBI says it's conducting Operation Cyberstrike in several cities. The agency says there is an underground network of pirating, and victims include major players like Microsoft and Sony. Experts say software piracy cost the industry $13 billion in 1995. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other NPR member stations, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve health and health care for all Americans.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cooking took on a new meaning for Chef Robert Lehman when he started cooking for people with AIDS. After working in restaurants and running a catering business, he became the chef at a Philadelphia group called MANA, which prepares and delivers meals for people with AIDS who are housebound. Now he's the project's coordinator for HIV nutrition research at the Graduate Hospital in Philadelphia. He's written a new book called Cooking for Life, a guide to nutrition and food safety for the HIV community. It's filled with advice on nutrition, dealing with diarrhea, and how to avoid food contamination, which is critical for someone with a compromised immune system. I asked Robert Lehman if there are foods that can slow down or reverse wasting, the extreme weight loss that usually accompanies AIDS.
You have to come at it from two angles. One is to offer as much that will supply lean body mass to a person, that's the protein component of their diet. And the other thing is to not do things that are going to aggravate the system, to cause diarrhea, to cause digestive upsets and things like that.
Why don't you compare some of the nutritional and caloric needs of people with AIDS to healthy people?
Well, as an example, people with compromised immune systems very frequently have infections, logically enough. For every degree of fever that you have, your metabolic needs increase by about 7%. So you can see even if you have a 3-degree fever, you should be taking in more than 20% more food than average, because you, even though you feel exhausted and are lying in bed, your body's actually burning a great deal of caloric nutritional material. And so you need a higher caloric intake just to maintain your baseline weight. Beyond that, the most important thing is not that you burn fat, but that you tend to burn lean body mass, first in your stores of muscle mass, and later as you compromise that, your organ tissues begin to become diminished, and therefore your body's overall metabolism becomes compromised.
People with AIDS have compromised immune systems, so they have to really take precautions that they're not eating any kind of food that will be carrying bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of things that we don't think about, or at least I don't think about, that you mentioned in your book that I thought, gee, we'd all better be thinking about this, even things like can openers.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what to be concerned about with a can opener.
Well, the greatest risk for food poisoning in this country is through cross-contamination. We have streamlined food delivery systems and refrigerations and everything else that prevent outright spoilage, but all too often people just will open a can and toss their can opener back in the drawer, and the minute particles of food that are left on the blade will just sit there and rot. They're a perfect culture for bacteria, and then they get forced into the next opened can. I don't think anybody would consider not washing down a cutting board or a knife, but that's what we do with a can opener. And so that's the single greatest vector of food poisoning in this country.
What about cutting boards? Wooden cutting boards can be great breeding grounds for bacteria. What do you suggest?
There's a great debate about wooden versus plastic cutting boards, but this has been studied ad nauseum, and plastic ones certainly are much easier to clean and sanitize. The best thing to do is to keep two cutting boards, one that you use for only things that you're going to eat raw, like if you cut up an apple, cut up salad greens, things like that, and another cutting board for things that are going to be cooked, like raw chicken, so that you never cross-contaminate the raw produce with raw animal products that are the greatest source of contagion.
What about microwaving food? Does that automatically kill any germs?
No, it does not. Microwaving is not a bad way to cook, particularly, but it does leave pockets of food undercooked if you don't do it correctly. That's why most modern microwaves have turntables, is to equalize that bombardment. But if something is very large or has an irregular shape to it, still there may be places where it's not thoroughly cooked. So just the microwave bombardment itself does not destroy bacteria.
Water. Can you drink tap water if you have a compromised immune system?
It's really a chancy consideration. Cryptosporidium, which is a microorganism that is increasing in the water supplies in America, is something that is extremely virulent, causes copious watery diarrhea, and we have no cure for at this point. This is not just a matter of something that we're becoming more conscious of. It is a growing problem in America. More and more cities are having outbreaks of it. And so filtered water that's properly filtered, most spring waters, things like that, are the safest route. This depends on how fragile your immune system is.
Oh, something I learned from your book is that it can be unsafe to eat stuffing that's packed into a chicken or a turkey. Mm-hmm. Explain why.
Well, in this country, one out of every four chickens has salmonella. And as you pack the stuffing into it, of course, it comes in contact with the raw chicken. And yet the interior of that stuffing rarely reaches the 160 degrees necessary to destroy the salmonella. And if you cook a stuffed turkey or chicken till the stuffing is that hot, the chicken is just destroyed. It is dry as a bone and just probably collapsing off the bone. It's so overcooked. So it's very rare that stuffing would be cooked until it was warm enough to destroy the bacteria.
So this bacteria, I suppose, is not a threat to average people, but if you have a compromised immune system,
well,
it could spell trouble?
It can spell trouble for anyone. It's actually estimated that 70% of the 24-hour flus and gastrointestinal upsets that we have in this country in the general population are actually mild cases of food poisoning. Food poisoning is actually very common, much more so than people tend to realize. But to give you an idea, the primary AIDS-defining illness in America is pneumocystis pneumonia, and there are about 25 cases of that diagnosed every day. Every day in America, 25 people die of food poisoning, and 16,000 people, it's estimated, become ill. So if you walk that back to the greater susceptibility, people with AIDS are 7 times more susceptible to salmonella poisoning, and they are between 200 and 300 times more susceptible to listeriosis. So food poisoning is a serious consideration for anyone, but it's a very, very serious consideration for someone with a compromised immune system.
Do you think it's safe for someone with a compromised immune system to eat in a restaurant where sanitary conditions are not always what we'd like them to be?
I would be very, very cautious about that. And the safest thing that you can do is to eat food that is served piping hot. I would not go to a salad bar, for instance. You don't know how it's been handled or who sneezed over it. But if something comes to you steaming hot, then it's probably still at a temperature that any contamination would have been destroyed.
Robert Lehman is my guest, and his new book is called Cooking for Life, A Guide to Nutrition and Food Safety for the HIV-Positive Community. Of course, one of the problems that people with AIDS often have is diarrhea. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem, frankly, that a lot of people have, not as consistently, but they have it or they're going to have it. And I think you have a lot of interesting advice for dealing with that problem. What are some of the best foods to eat if you have diarrhea?
The famous diet that was developed by the San Francisco General Hospital is called the BRAT diet. And that stands for bananas, rice, applesauce, tea, and toast. And those all have elements of either soluble fiber and electrolyte repletions. Bananas are good soluble fiber, which help bind the contents of the intestine, and it provides potassium, which you tend to flush out with diarrhea. Rice means white rice, again, a soluble fiber component. Toast means white bread toast. These are the refined foods that normally are not the healthiest ones for us to eat, but in times of diarrhea, they are the things that tend to bind our intestines to help modify the diarrhea. Of course, it's what binds people in normal life to make them constipated also. So it's not the diet that you want to be on all the time.
What foods would you just say avoid?
Greasy, fatty foods is absolutely the first. Caffeine is another, which means coffee, chocolates, that sort of thing. And then, again, any of those things with soluble fiber. Kernels of corn tend to pass through all of our intestinal tracts intact. You know, they're just going to push along anything that's there. And one of the problems, one of the reasons that diarrhea is of such dire concern is not just the quality of life issue, which is significant in and of itself, but the fact that it can create wasting. And there are a couple ways it does that. One is simply what it's called gut transit time. Things pass through our system so rapidly that our intestinal tracts don't have time to absorb the nutrients from them. So though we're eating food, we're not getting the nutrients that we need from that food. And then secondly, a way that we absorb our food is that our intestinal tracts are lined with microscopic villi. They're little hair-like extensions that give the intestinal tract its enormous surface area that allows it to absorb food. And in times of diarrhea, that begins to slough off. So instead of having a football field surface area in your intestinal tract, you start having a small patio or just a tabletop worth of absorptive mucosa. And that prevents your being able to absorb nutrients also. And once you begin to lose that absorptive surface, then there's nothing you can do in terms until it restores itself. But no amount of food that you're going to eat is going to stick, as it were.
You say that the best advice you could give for diarrhea is to drink a drink that you have a recipe for. What is it and why is it good for you?
Well, there are two things that happen in terms of diarrhea can also lead to dehydration. Mm-hmm. Actually, the most common AIDS-related admissions to San Francisco General Hospital have to do with dehydration from diarrhea. So it is of paramount importance that you continue your fluid intake. Along with that fluid intake, you want electrolyte repletion, which is what sports beverages are all about. We all tend to flush out salts when we sweat. This is why football players used to take salt tablets when they would practice in the summer heat. Potassium and chloride are the other electrolytes that we tend to just flush out very rapidly. The recipe that I give in the book for horchata, which is a traditional Spanish beverage, is actually one that has steeped the soluble fiber component out of the rice so that it's a rice water, and then it has some adding of baking soda, basically, in order to replete the sodium and the chloride that we've lost through flushing our systems through the diuretic effect of diarrhea.
How does it taste?
I wouldn't drink
You're
it.
You're
I wouldn't drink it for a cocktail in the afternoon, but I think it's fine.
You also recommend Gatorade.
Gatorade was designed exactly as an electrolyte repletion formula, and it, you know, some people complain that it's salty, but the salt is one of the points of Gatorade, was that we flush the salt out of our systems when we sweat or when we pass a great deal of urine or when we vomit also. That's another potential source for dehydration.
Some people with AIDS try macrobiotic diets.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've heard good things about it. It's supposed to be cleansing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, this is, I'm sure, going to be a hot button, but as I say in my book, that you could hardly design a worse diet for someone with any advanced HIV/AIDS. And there are several reasons for that. One, it is very low in protein as a diet, and protein intake is the single greatest nutritional importance for this diet. It is also very high in insoluble fiber, which tends to clean people out under the best of circumstances, but with someone with diarrhea can absolutely ravage their digestional tract. And it tends to be very low in calories in general, so that if you have someone who is in a wasting syndrome to begin with, you don't want to lower their caloric intake, you want to increase it. So it really has threefold strikes against it. Now, I'm sure I will get a lot of flack about this in general. There is some more or less anecdotal evidence that people who are HIV positive but asymptomatic might benefit from a macrobiotic diet, but there's not really any substantial research to prove that. The fact is, macrobiotics may be a perfect diet for everyone in America who's overweight and constipated, as most Americans are, but for someone who is rapidly losing weight and having copious diarrhea, it's apt to be deadly.
What do you think of a vegetarian diet?
I think it's perfectly possible to eat healthfully with a vegetarian diet. Again, since protein intake is so important to someone with AIDS, vegetarian diets tend to be low in protein. It is possible to eat vegetarian diets that provide complementary proteins, like beans and rice. Everyone knows that that makes a complementary protein. One of the things, though, to consider is that there are sort of a hierarchy of quality of and bioavailability of proteins. For instance, if you eat beans and rice, you do get the 22 amino acids that you need to for your body to utilize the protein, but your body has to work hard to combine those. An analogy. You've probably heard that it takes more calories to digest celery than there are in celery.
Mm-hmm.
So if you eat celery, you're actually sort of taking in negative calories. It's a little bit the same with beans and rice, is that your body has to work harder to process those complementary proteins to utilize them. Whereas if you eat eggs or dairy products or meat, your body does not have to work so hard. So you're having less outgo of metabolic energy vis-a-vis your intake of protein and calorie.
My guest is Robert Lehman. He's the author of the new book, Cooking for Life, A Guide to Nutrition and Food Safety for the HIV-Positive Community. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Robert Lehman is my guest, and his new book is called Cooking for Life, A Guide to Nutrition and Food Safety for the HIV-Positive Community. Now, you got involved in this approach to cooking because you were the head chef in Philadelphia at a place called MANA, which stands for?
It's the Metropolitan AIDS Neighborhood Nutrition Alliance.
And so you prepared tens of thousands of dinners for people dinners to be delivered to people with AIDS.
Yes.
So you'd cook these dinners in huge amounts, and they'd be delivered to people with AIDS. Many of us have been in the hospital. We've tasted hospital food. What did you want your dinners to be like, especially when compared to hospital food?
Anything but that. I talked to a dietitian who works nationally at the AIDS conference in Vancouver, and she was telling me about a program that she had worked with where they had gotten rid of the food and beverage services at one hospital and hired chefs and individuals who cooked real food, and they found several things happen. One, their food costs went down. Two, their client stays became shorter, and the nutritional profiles improved because people were actually eating the food instead of just leaving it on the tray. So it is useless to give people food that they're not going to eat. And so when I was at MANA, we spent a great deal of time on presentation as well as the nutritional component and, you know, the appropriateness of the menu. But again, if you don't make the food appealing and people don't eat it, then it's the tree falling in the forest. It makes no sound at all.
What were your values in presentation of the food?
I did not want it to look like I didn't want it to look forbiddingly fancy. I didn't want it to look too much like a fancy restaurant, but I wanted it to look loving. I wanted it to look like some mom had fussed over it somewhere. And we did things like, we would carve up cherry tomatoes or put desserts on doilies and give them a shake of powdered sugar or something. I wanted it to look like fancy home cooking, but not like restaurant food particularly.
And not institutional.
Not institutional by a long stretch. One of the components of that is to keep the colors juxtaposed and very lively and bright. It's very easy when you're making food for someone who's sick that it all becomes beige. You know, there's all just a brown tonality to it.
Mashed potatoes and what else?
Mashed potatoes and roast chicken.
Anything
stewed.
Uh-huh.
But visual stimulation really does stimulate our appetite a great deal. And so keeping bright colors was important to me.
Now, how much of an issue was appetite for the people with AIDS you were cooking for?
Many people have diminished appetite, and it happens for lots of reasons. Early satiety, so that you just have a few mouthfuls of something and you're full, is one problem. Depression is, of course, a very common problem with people who are facing a terminal illness. And so would have to continue to stimulate their interest in the food. One day I got a call from a manna client, and he gave me exactly the compliment I would have asked for. He called and said, you know, this is almost gourmet food. I used to not be very interested in food, but now I kind of wait around and see what's coming for lunch. And that was exactly what the balance I had hoped to achieve, was not strangeness, but just something to pique his curiosity, to make him always wonder what the next day's meal was going to be. And I think that's important to do for someone who's sick.
I'm sure your whole sense of what it meant to be a chef changed when you were cooking for people who were sick. It wasn't just like a night out to relax and enjoy food. It was really like life and death.
Mm-hmm.
And you were cooking specially designed meals to help them get nutrients and to inspire them to eat,
mm-hmm.
and hopefully give them some pleasure, too. Did you get to meet many of the people who you were cooking for?
Well, in the early days of Manna, when our client base was not so large, I made a point of delivering to each client as they came onto our service, because I wanted to get a thorough understanding of who these people were, how they lived, what their homes, you know, looked like, who they were. And though I had dealt with people with AIDS in the past in several different capacities, I was never so impressed before by how people had this frail grasp on life. And the image that was so vivid to me was, we have all seen images of Holocaust survivors and how painfully emaciated they were. And I never could understand how someone could be that wasted and still be alive, how the body supports life at that point when it's little more than skeleton and bone. And yet, beginning to know some of those people with AIDS in that condition, I had a visceral understanding that I can't quite put into words, but somehow I could understand how those people continued to live. And so the food became support for that heroic effort to people maintaining their life.
Robert Lehman is the author of Cooking for Life, A Guide to Nutrition and Food Safety in the HIV-Positive Community. He's also projects coordinator for HIV Nutrition Research at the Graduate Hospital in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thomas Jefferson wrote, "All men are created equal, yet he owns slaves." That's one of the contradictions Ken Burns explores in his new PBS film on Jefferson. We'll talk with Burns about the movie. And commentator Gerald Early wonders about the past and future of Fisk University, a school whose first students were former slaves. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Thomas Jefferson wrote the words that have guided America since its creation and reflect us at our best. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Yet, Jefferson was a slaveholder. That's just one of the contradictions Ken Burns explores in his new documentary on Jefferson, which will be shown on PBS stations February 18th and 19th. Burns describes it as the prequel to his Civil War series, which was the highest-rated series in PBS history. Burns also made the PBS series on baseball. Before we get to some of the contradictions in Jefferson's character, let's just sum up why he's so important.
He is the author of our country. He wrote our creed. That one sentence, the second sentence of the Declaration, is our creed. It's what we all agree as Americans is true, you know, inalienable, that this is moot. We're not going to talk about this anymore. This is what we have. He is, therefore, the author of our essential freedoms. He is the author of our political freedoms, obviously issuing from that great Declaration and other remarkable writing. He is the codifier, one of the authors, of our religious freedom, something that some scholars think is even more important and significant than the political achievement. He said, for the first time in human history, something that went against the grain of every tendency of human beings. He said, we will separate the processes of our political and social lives from the dictates of our religion. And that has made all the difference for us. He's the author of our intellectual freedoms. He founded the first university in the history of the world not connected with a church or its dogma. That has set in motion our modern life. And he could have followed John Locke and said life, liberty, and property. It would been perfectly reasonable thing to do. Instead, he said life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we have been wondering what he meant ever since. You know, what's happiness? Is it meaning that you're going to be in a good mood? Is it the acquisition of material things? What is happiness? And I think what he did more than anything else is he said that Americans and America wasn't an end in and of itself, but something that was constantly questing. It wasn't happiness. And by happiness, he didn't mean the hedonistic pursuit of things at the mall. He meant the improvement of the mind and the heart, a kind of spiritual growth that would be possible once life and liberty were done. It was the marketplace of ideas.
And what he wanted to guarantee was its pursuit, not its
and the
accomplishment.
Absolutely right, that it isn't happiness. You never get it. Perfection's impossible. It's the pursuit of us. And that, I think, for Americans has made all the difference.
Let's get to the idea that Thomas Jefferson writes, all men are created equal, and then holds, what, 200 slaves?
At its height, more than 200 human beings.
What were you able to find out about the kind of slaveholder he was?
Well, I think he was a fairly, this is so hard to say, he was a fairly enlightened slave owner. He considered his slaves part of his family. He had a kind of patronizing, in a good way, attitude towards this family. But at the same time, he owned them. You know, one of his nephews murdered one of his slaves because they dropped a teacup and broke a teacup that had belonged to their mother. And the important thing that we forget is that slavery isn't an abstract thing that we debate, that these are real lives lived, being denied the chance to learn a written language, being denied the chance to keep a family together. They changed the wedding vows, till death or distance do we part.
Really?
Yeah, because it might be economically advantageous to break up a family.
Now, he wrote a little bit about slaves and about Africans who were brought to America, and he described them as being intellectually inferior, as smelling really badly because of the makeup of their bodies, not because they weren't allowed to bathe.
This is scientific racism.
Right.
And he is he wrote one book in his life, Notes on the State of Virginia, which is a rambling, wonderful book. But in it, he has these statements that stab you, wound you to the heart about the inferiority of blacks. There's lots of questioning, too. He thinks that he may be condemning a whole race prematurely. He doesn't know. You see it as this restless, tormenting question for him all the time.
Could you just say, well, everybody of Jefferson's stature had slaves, so it would be expecting too much for even Jefferson to be different. Would that be...
I want to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to say, you know, one of the things I hate as an amateur historian is the arrogance of the present to assume that it can go back to the past and pronounce some judgments, you know. And one of the great people who rush very sincerely to his defense say, oh, he's a man of his time.
Right.
You know? But I don't think you can do that. His neighbor, Edward Coles, freed his slaves and really urged vociferously for Jefferson to do the same. Jefferson didn't respond. His mentor, George Washington, eventually freed his slaves. His cousin, John Randolph, freed his slaves. Free black population of Virginia is growing all the time. And Jefferson's not doing something. And a lot of this, to be fair to him, is tied up with his debts. He inherits a lot of his slaves and land from his father-in-law when he dies. And he also inherits a lot of debt. And he's constantly scrambling all his adult life, not very conscientiously, but scrambling nonetheless to sort of free himself of this debt. And I think he feels in some ways imprisoned that he can't let go. You know, he once said about slavery, it was like holding a wolf by the ears. You didn't like it, but you didn't dare let go. It's a great image, and I think it's less a political description than it is his own personal anguish. At the same time, you can't let the man who writes the most important statement about human freedom completely off the hook. We celebrate him today, as our consultant Paul Finkelman said. We don't build a memorial, and we don't put somebody on the nickel who's just a man of his time. I think in some ways the most difficult thing for me was to confront, to really hold his feet to the fire, to listen to John Hope Franklin with the knowledge that he was speaking the truth, but a great deal of pain when he said, the legacy of Jefferson is both a blessing and a curse.
He is said to have had a sexual relationship with one of his slaves, Sally Hemings, and to be the father of her children. Your film is inconclusive about that. Some people say, oh, he definitely did. Others say it's really unlikely that he did.
I wanted to leave it that way, too. It's really important to me for a number of reasons. First of all, one of the historians said that if it really came to a trial right now, and when he says that, I hear O.J.,
right,
that he would probably be found not guilty. That is to say, there would not be enough conclusive evidence either way. You can't prove or disprove it, though there is poignant testimony of the descendants of Sally Hemings who believe that their great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather is the third president of the United States. And these are light-skinned African Americans with reddish hair and freckles, looking very much like an offspring of Thomas Jefferson.
And who have had the story handed and down from generation to generation in oral history.
The most credible thing is this oral history, lacking the conclusive proof. And there are historians of all stripe who vehemently say this is impossible, this is outside the character. To me, I think it enters into, and this was, remember, promoted as a scandal. A newspaper man that used to work for Jefferson, savaging the Federalists, got angry at Jefferson. He didn't give him enough political plums. He went over to the Federalists, and the first thing he did is savage Jefferson in the by-elections of 1802 with the scandal mongering. So it's very contemporary. The thing that I think the Sally Hemings story has fed into is our late 20th century tabloid sensibility, the kind of did he or didn't he. No matter who you are, college professor, angry student, it comes down to did he or didn't he. And it has a kind of sexual titillation to it. I wanted to step back and say the most important thing here that we shouldn't lose sight of, despite the obvious power and domination that sex and all of that implies between a man and a female, and particularly a master and a slave, is that he owned her, that he could have done anything with her. He could have killed her. And that we sometimes forget that. That's at the center of it. And as John Hope Franklin said, so he may or may not have fathered her children, but we can hold him responsible for all of those illicit, difficult, dark relationships that take place in the secrecy of this horrible institution which we tolerated for too long in this country, called chattel slavery.
My guest is Ken Burns, and his new film on Thomas Jefferson will be shown on public television February 18th and 19th. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back with Ken Burns and his film Thomas Jefferson will be shown on public television February 18th and 19th. Well, we've been talking about the contradiction between saying all men are created equal and owning slaves, and that's hardly the only contradiction in his character. He was against a very strong federal government and then goes on to become our third president. What are some of the things he did as third president that maybe didn't quite jive with his philosophy?
Well, it's important to give him credit that having watched what he felt was the wrong interpretation of the Constitution by the Federalists, that is to say, a too strong central government, he really set about eliminating the Alien and Sedition Acts that had so troubled civil libertarians, including himself, and really gutted a lot of the federal government, let the Navy, unfortunately, sort of shrink down. But he did an amazing thing. You'll have to look at his presidency. The single most important accomplishment is that he purchased Louisiana from the French, thereby doubling the size of the country. It was a sum nearly twice the federal budget. It's the greatest land deal in history. It's the best decision that any president would have made in that case. But it ran counter to this love of small government. And he so ensured the continental nation that we'd become. I mean, manifest destiny becomes a practical consideration the moment we buy Louisiana.
It as your film points out, it like doubles the amount of land.
It's an amazing
gets
thing.
The French basically out of
what
it
does
States.
Is it actually the French know that they're not really going to be able to hang on to things. So that by selling us Louisiana, they've put a kind of check in front of the British. And for us to buy Louisiana, we're happy to do that because we can provide a buffer to the British. We become a world power at that moment, a developing world power. But it's great geopolitics that Jefferson and Napoleon are playing. And Napoleon says, I have just given the world a rival to Britain.
You're interested not only in Jefferson's actions, but in his private life, too, yeah. And how his private life might have affected his public life. When he was writing the Declaration of Independence, what was happening in his personal life?
Well, he'd already lost a child in childbirth or early on. And his wife was there, sick, with the birth of another child who eventually died. He was constantly torn all his life between this sense of wishing to be on the political stage and retreating. Some of it was really false. I mean, he was a shrewd political operator and didn't hesitate to hire people like James Callender who would savage the Federalists at every turn. But he's always desiring to go back into the lap and the love of his family and his farm. And he constantly not just threatens to retire, he does retire. He quits as Secretary of State. He basically goes home as Vice President. He's always being pulled back to a family life, which you can see by going to Monticello was a wonderfully sustaining thing. But when you read what happened in his own life, it just must have been, you know, he never came to terms with grief. He was constantly losing people, and he could never figure out in the midst of all of his great thoughts what to do with the loss that was afflicting him all the time.
And who was he losing while he was writing the Declaration?
He was losing a child, and eventually, not too long after the Revolution ended, his wife, Martha, called Patty, died in a very long sickness in which he stayed by her at the last moments. It's really an incredibly poignant scene, and when he dies, he just loses it. For 3 weeks, he's completely sleeps on the floor. He wails. He moans. He forges a connection with his daughter, Martha, who they call Patsy at that time. And fortunately for him, for us, Patsy survives him. It's the only child. Five of the six children die. And I can't, as a father myself, just even think about what that must have done.
Jefferson wanted to see separation of church and state in America. Really forceful advocate for that, obviously. What were his own religious views? What was his own religious life like?
It was, at first blush, fairly unstructured. He's sort of called a deist. And in fact, the election, what made the election of 1800 so absolutely worse, I mean, when we complain today, it was nothing. Robbery, rape, murder, mayhem, one Federalist paper said, will occur openly. Our daughters will be sent into whorehouses if Thomas Jefferson is elected. They saw him as godless, as a complete atheist. But in fact, Jefferson, refers to the Creator in his one great sentence. He edited the Gospels of Jesus Christ, editing out what he thought was sort of the extravagance, the hyperbole, the stuff, and kept what he felt were the true words of Jesus. And today we still read and look through a pasted collection of the Gospels, which we call the Jefferson Bible, which apparently he turned to at times of comfort when he lost a daughter or a wife. And this is at the heart of him, I think, is a person who is not a-religious, but so intensely personal in his relationship to his Creator, here at the boiling point of rationalism, you know, where he's looking for facts, you know. Are there Welsh Indians out there where Lewis and Clark can find them? Are there hills of pure salt? Are there volcanoes? Are there still woolly mammoths? You know, I want to know all the time. And I think we tend to dismiss a side that is, from his writings, betray an incredibly spiritual sensitivity.
So he's editing the Bible, huh?
He's editing the Bible, if you can believe it.
So what are some of the things he edited out?
Well, you know, it's funny. You can I don't have a specific example, but as you look at it, I mean, it's a cut and paste job. And he's sitting there taking Matthew or Luke or John, and he's cutting out. So you might go from line, you know, chapter 2, line 39 to line 44. And what he's losing is what he thinks is apocryphal. He wants to hear the practical words of a great teacher. Is how I think it is, and this is no scholarship behind my interpretation. I just sort of feel that as I look at the Jefferson Bible, he's seeing Christ as a great teacher, a moral teacher, and he's hoping that we can inherit what is something essential in Christianity.
Thomas Jefferson lived in an era before photography.
Yeah.
So you're stuck making a film about Thomas Jefferson because there's no pictures.
And I don't want it to be the powdered wig, white quill pen, green felt table stuff that is the kind of broccoli and cauliflower of documentary films. I wanted the 18th century to come alive as much as you can make, say, the 19th century come alive because there's an abundant use of photographs.
So what'd you use?
I cheated and I used some photographs. I actually hired a cameraman who took an early primitive camera, the closest process I could find to Jefferson's time, back to Monticello and just document every square foot of Monticello so that it would be possible to zoom through one photograph, dissolve into another, and feel perhaps like you were moving through a space. And I think it's fairly successful. It's a kind of 18th or 19th century virtual reality that I think helps you ground yourself in the place. We are more dependent on live cinematography, which has always been a hallmark of the type of work we've done, that is to place yourself in front of the ghosts and echoes of this inexpressibly wise past and wait and see what happens, you know, at dawn, at sunset. So there's lots of that, covering Monticello, going to Paris, going to Philadelphia, you know, all around, trying to collect his life, the places that he'd been. And the paintings, to some extent, fill it out. I work with the independent filmmaker, cinematographer Peter Hutton, who does work so completely different than mine. But I've hired him on every film, and he went with his small little Bolex camera and took sort of jerry-rigged time-lapse of moments, very shaky black-and-white footages of light dappled on wallpaper or on walls or chairs. And what we were straining to do was to try to take back from Monticello more than the postcard view of it, and to hopefully intimate that there was once an interesting man who lived here with a family that was dying all around him, with grandchildren who he loved, with slaves who offered him sort of exquisite torture. That was important to come back with that stuff.
Have you ever thought, oh, this will be an interesting project, and you started it and you thought, this really actually isn't very interesting, and I'm not finding anything that I'm looking for here, and I think I will abandon it?
No, I'm very fortunate. I want to knock on wood. I have finished the projects that I've started. And I think in part because it finally doesn't matter what they were. I mean, of course it does. It's central to who it is. It's just like the people that we end up with as friends or even mates for life. It's not so much that it is them that we've found the only one. It is that here that we have agreed to park and practice. In the case of friends and loved ones, how you get along with people, how you love, what's unconditional love. In the case of film projects, you park next to a subject and you say, I'm here. This is what I've chosen. Each one has its own peculiar problems to it, and each one sort of reveals your own problems to yourself, you know, your orneriness, your crankiness, your stubbornness, whatever it is that's your foible, it'll always kick up in a new and interesting way, and you always struggle. Sometimes it comes at the beginning of the project, sometimes not till the beyond the rough cut. You struggle for that moment when you say, oh yeah, this is more than the sum of its parts, it's about this. And it's always a great moment that you wait for, you pray that it will happen. But I've yet to sort of say, oof, you know, this isn't really my cup of tea.
Well, Ken Burns, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Derry.
Ken Burns' film about Thomas Jefferson will be shown on PBS stations February 18th and 19th. Coming up, some thoughts on an African-American university whose first students included former slaves. This is Fresh Air. Gerald Early usually spends the academic year at Washington University, where he teaches English and heads the Department of African and Afro-American Studies. But this year he's in Nashville, writing a book about the history of Fisk University. He's been thinking about the future of all black universities such as Fisk and what it means to him to be there now. We've asked him to share some of those thoughts in an ongoing series of commentaries.
It's a good idea not to romanticize anything that happens to you. That just makes it harder to understand why people do what they do, why people are what they are. Now, I went to Fisk 2 years ago with the thought that I would have some sort of revelation teaching at a black school. That really didn't happen. I returned to Fisk this fall with a clearer head and a clearer purpose. Learn about the place and write the book. Do not expect epiphanies about what it means to be black. Now I can more fully understand what Fisk can give me and what it can't. People at Fisk were glad to see me back, and I was glad to be back. Most were pleased to know that I was determined to write this book. Besides, the campus seems happier today. The lawns are neater, there is renovation and construction, a sense of hopefulness. Walking across the main thoroughfare of this campus, one is struck by a pleasant intimacy that suggests its glory days in the 1950s under Charles S. Johnson, social scientist, Harlem Renaissance mover and shaker, and the school's first black president. But those were glory days, and Fisk is not that school anymore. It is while walking across this campus today that one senses the clash of two jarring elements, Fisk's glorious past and its uncertain future. One vividly meets Fisk's past every October 6th, Jubilee Day, when the school celebrates not its founder, nor its great donors, but a small band of students who, in 1871, saved the school from closing almost as soon as it had opened. These courageous young men and women, fresh from the confines of slavery, went forth unto a hostile Reconstruction America armed with that great American folk music, the spirituals. They saved their fledgling school and introduced to the world a memorable art form. On October 6th, faculty, alumni, students, staff, and friends go to the gravesite of four of these original Jubilee singers to pray, to sing, to remember. I watched it all with wonder and deep respect. It is a very moving ceremony. But Fisk is currently searching for a new president to take the school into the 21st century. So the future is on everyone's mind here. Can this small, private, poorly endowed school survive in the fiercely competitive world of higher education today? The elite black students it used to get, now, by and large, get skimmed off by the white schools. Its name does not have the same glamour among historically black colleges and universities that it used to have. It has survived its financial and leadership crises of the 1970s and early 80s, when everyone in higher education thought the school would surely close. But it has survived at a cost to its reputation. Does White Nashville see the school as essential to the history of the city, more important historically than Vanderbilt? Does Black Nashville and Black America itself still feel that schools like Fisk have an important mission in the world and not just a memory of a mission? No one can walk these grounds and think of the people who attended and worked at this school and see Fisk as just another school after all. Fisk is a special place. It will need a special person to lead it, a person who can understand the past but not be trapped by it. I have learned to enjoy Fisk and in some small measure even to know it, but I remain an outsider looking in. But I think every Fiskite, past and present, realizes the one great lesson of the original Jubilee Singers. The school's past is built on how deeply committed people were to its future and to the sacrifice and glory of venturing bravely into uncharted waters. It's a lesson Fisk needs to remember now.
Gerald Early is currently on sabbatical from Washington University, where he teaches English and directs the Department of African and Afro-American Studies. He's the author of The Culture of Bruising, essays on prize-fighting, literature, and modern American culture. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Regina O'Toole is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.